Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi, folks. Just to say, we know the world number one and defending champion Iga Świątek lost tonight. We know that means she lost her number one ranking tonight, and it will be covered in technicolor detail, don't you worry. But if you've been listening to the podcast throughout this fortnight, you know that we've been recording in two parts, and the first part is recorded after the day session, and the second part is recorded after the night session. So you just have to wait till part two to hear all about Yelena Ostapenko against Iga Świątek. It's coming, though. Enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome, folks, to a sticky evening in New York City. Day six of the US Open, day six of daily tennis podcasts from the US Open, brought to you for the fortnight in association, in partnership with AO Travel, who operate the travel program for the first Grand Slam of the year, the Australian Open in Melbourne. AO Travel can take care of your flights, premium accommodation, tickets to the tournament, behind-the-scenes experiences, including the all-new AO Travel Lounge. And it is to celebrate the launch of the AO Travel Lounge that we have this incredible competition and incredible competition prize. One lucky tennis podcast listener is going to win an AO Travel Premium Lounge package for themselves and a friend to visit the Australian Open in style next January. 2 return economy flights to Melbourne, tickets to Rod Laver Arena Tennis over the middle weekend of the Open for 2 people, and 3 nights accommodation at the 5-star Pullman on the Park Hotel in Melbourne, which does a delicious butter chicken on room service 24 hours a day, as well as 2-day access to the luxurious AO Travel Lounge. You can enter the prize draw today by clicking on the link provided in your show notes or in tonight's newsletter. So do subscribe to the newsletter if you don't already. You have until Monday the 18th of September at 11:59 p.m. New York time to enter. Terms and conditions apply. Good luck. This is part one of the show where we wrap up what we've seen in the day session. We'll be back later with part two and all the drama that unfolds under the lights. And today we have a special politics corner coming up in part one, because there has been a big scoop by none other than our very own of this parish, Simon Briggs of the Daily Telegraph, and it's caused a bit of a stir in Flushing Meadows today. So what better reason, what better moment to welcome Mr. Simon Briggs onto the podcast?
Hello. I haven't noticed much of a stir, but then I might have got in a little bit late this afternoon.
We've been stirring.
We've been stirring for you, Simon.
Excellent.
We'll come on to the politics a little later. Let's first start with Coco Gauff, because we have all just come from her press conference. She beat Caroline Wozniacki today 6-3, 3-6, 6-1 to reach back-to-back quarterfinals here at the US Open. It was an interesting match, wasn't it? I mean, it was a whole 3-act play all in itself, that match. 5-act play if you include the on-court interview and the press conference afterwards. Lots to take in, lots going on.
Yeah, because I think
aside from anything else, Wozniacki is an opponent unlike anybody Goff had faced so far. In all of the other matches, Brad Gelbert could say to her, keep it physical, make it physical, and that would be a good idea. But in Wozniacki, in some ways, she was playing a replica of herself. You know, great backhand, great movement, not very good forehand, relatively speaking. I do think Goff's got a much better serve. But, you know, it was getting dicey there. I mean, at one set all, and when Wozniacki broke for one love in the third set, it could so easily have tailspinned for the player who's down in front of their own fans. She's supposed to win. She's playing somebody who's retired for 3.5 years and come back. And actually, I give Goff enormous credit for the fact that she just threw off those shackles at that very point. I love players who produce their best tennis of the match when they're under the gun like that, and she did.
Yeah, I thought acts 1 and 3, to use your terms, Catherine, were quite similar in the start of the first set. Wozniacki went up a break, and already I was thinking, oh no, this is bad for the movement if Caroline Wozniacki were to beat Coco Gauff. But quite quickly, actually, Coco Gauff got the match back under control and played a pretty good first set. Played quite aggressively when she could. Reeled off 10 points in a row at one stage, was using her forehand well, opening up the court with the wide serve. There was lots of good stuff. As David said, similar game styles, but Gauff seems to have more what Americans call upside, you know, more strengths that she can really use. Then her game really fell off in that second set, Gauff. There was an alarming amount of errors in that set, and Wozniacki was by far the better player, getting in all the service games, having a lot of break points, eventually taking it. And then the start of the third set, Act 3, Gauff goes up a break again, just as she did at the start of the first set. And it was at this point where I think the match got really, really interesting, because everyone watching on the TV was able to pick up what Brad Gelbert was saying in the box. And what he was saying was, it's time to make it physical. And Coco Gauff said towards her box, please stop talking. And then proceeded to not make it physical and actually go back to the sort of tactic that had worked in that first set and shortening the points, taking over, and seemed to be completely ignoring all the advice that was coming from the box. So it was really, really fascinating, that period of the match. And then Wozniacki tailed off, I think, quite dramatically in that third set, and Gauff ended up running away with it, really, 6-1. But yeah, and of course that back and forth between Gauff and her box was sort of one of the talking points in that press conference. How much is Gauff going to really own that, and how much is she going to maybe row back from it? And she was keen to point out that she wasn't directly talking at Brad Gelbert.
It's a fascinating situation and dynamic, this Brad Gelbert situation with Coco Gauff, isn't it? Because the results speak for themselves. Brad Gelbert coaches players to Grand Slam titles. I have backed her to win this US Open, partly because Brad Gelbert is in her corner. And yet, what I'm actually witnessing of the coaching relationship is a bloke repeatedly shouting, keep it physical, and various other instructions, which, when ignored, are to Coco Gauff's benefit. Now, she totally defends him, and look, she's in the quarterfinals. I still really think she has a chance of winning this. I just don't quite get it. Like, that, it's working, but what you see with your eyes on the court isn't necessarily a great advert for what I'm sure is good stuff going on behind the scenes.
Well, we talked before about how his main message has been, don't think about your forehand, just get on and play. Maybe that's what's inspiring her. I mean, to me, the Achilles forehand was out there in spades in the second set. Now, the system on the press room monitors is telling me that she hit 16 unforced errors on her forehand side in the second set. Unfortunately, when I started looking at the third set, I discovered that the press room monitors were, like, completely inaccurate and were logging the numbers all over the shop. So my report, which I filed before I realised that, may turn out to be somewhat misinformed.
Oh, do buy tomorrow's Telegraph, folks.
Yeah. It says she hit one forehand winner in the third set, but in fact there were plenty. So it's had a malfunction, which is quite concerning for a bloke who uses it all day long for his stories. Anyway, Brad Gilbert, yeah, we just had a press conference where she said that he has to have a Jolly Rancher on the go to chew whenever he's on the court, and that he only mentions odd numbers because even numbers freak him out.
Yes, if you ask him what time it is, David, even if it is 7:18 p.m. he will say either 7:17 or 7:19 p.m. because he refuses to acknowledge odd numbers.
Okay.
Even numbers, rather, sorry.
Yeah. So not a massive surprise to me, given the Brad that I know, who I do think is an excellent coach. But it was very interesting hearing him say it's time to use loop and shape and air underneath the ball, and not try to go through her. And then the next two points, she went directly through her with two of the biggest ground strokes of the match.
He specifically said, don't try and play through her.
Yeah.
And then she specifically went out there and played through her, and it worked.
Coco van der Weyen, in our commentary box, was saying, sometimes, honestly, you just try to prove your coach wrong in those situations.
Wow, that's interesting.
And I think what we are getting, maybe more than just an insight into the relationship, is we're getting an insight into all relationships, because finally we're getting to hear them. And if you think of the number of times you've seen Andy Murray come up and rant against whoever is in his coaching box, from Ivan Lendl to Miles McLagan to Alex Kurecha to whoever
Gilbert.
It is, to Brad Gilbert, had we had the microphones on the TV that they have today, we would have heard so much stuff that would have informed at least our conversations on the podcast in a different way, I think.
Do you think it needs to be whole hog and have the coaches on the court like we have at various different team events? Does this feel a bit sort of
I'm enjoying
in either camp at the moment?
I'm enjoying what we've got.
Well, then why not lean into it more?
Yeah.
And make it even more accessible, not sort of having to strain to listen in sometimes.
I don't really like
translation.
I wouldn't want interruption. I mean, I think it's quite interesting when are you thinking of sort of United Cup style thing where you've got
Tim
Henman out
that,
there? Or
I'm just hearing that talked about more and more, the fact that generally people seem to be enjoying at this tournament what they're getting from the on-court coaching, and yet it's still slightly limited by the practicalities of it.
Yeah.
You're only down your coaching box end 50% of the time, so it's only accessible to you if you happen to be down that end.
It's made me have to think about it in commentary, because a couple of times I would be speaking and then I didn't catch that they were saying something and I'm kind of talking over them. You've almost got a time when you talk as a commentator for when they're walking over and predict that they're going to say something, you better shut up so that everybody can hear it. But I really do enjoy it. I mean, because, you know, when they were talking about it, I was against it in many ways. But what we said all along was they have to mic this stuff up.
Mm.
And here at the US Open, they are micing the thing up.
One of the things I was always worried about with on-court coaching was that it would make players too reliant on their coach. And I was out in watching qualifying the other week, and I was sat right behind a coach on the outside court, and he was literally telling his player where to serve and what serve to hit on every single point when she was down his end and serving. And I thought that didn't seem particularly healthy. Like, you want tennis players to be able to think for themselves, which is why I think it was interesting that Goff completely ignored the advice that she was getting today. Like, that was kind of an element I hadn't considered of on-court coaching. I sort of just assumed that players would take their coach's word as sort of gospel. But that's interesting to hear Coco van der Weyen say, actually, sometimes you think you know better and you want to prove your coach wrong. And then on the Brad Gilbert of it all, the sort of interesting element here is that he's never actually been allowed to talk like this to his players before when he was coaching in the past. You know, he would have been, I'm sure, trying to get messages across, but not able to actually speak in the same way that he is now that coaching is allowed. And, you know, for someone who does like to talk a lot, Goff seemed to be suggesting that sometimes she doesn't actually want to hear from him quite so much. Sometimes she wants to go over to her towel and reset and not have people talking. And I still think he needs to work that out a little bit, of when he gives his advice and when he doesn't. And that's an interesting element for someone who's been coaching for so long. He's now doing it under new rules. And, you know, it's everyone is sort of learning, I suppose, with the new rules.
I think Coco surprised a lot of people in pre-tournament press when she used the word relaxing as her description of Brad. But then I went back to the Agassi book to see what he said about working with Brad. And he talked about their very first hit together, and how the message from Gilbert had been, you don't have to hit a killer shot every shot. Give your opponent space to make mistakes. And he said that permission to give up his inner perfectionist was really important to him. So in a weird way, the message is relaxing, even if maybe the delivery of Gilbert is quite intense.
Yeah, it is all absolutely fascinating. Caroline Wozniacki, as we come to you now, hasn't been into press quite yet. She's due in very shortly. I imagine when she does come in, she's going to have something to say about the fact that the lights weren't put on as she wanted them to be at 5 p.m. She was complaining that she couldn't see the ball properly. And look, it was bizarre to me because it was just completely daylight, but her serve did kind of drop off a cliff.
And they did turn them on. Suddenly they turned them on, but I guess not at the time she wanted them to.
No,
but you're right, she was all over the place suddenly.
Mm. Yeah. Does her comeback have legs?
I think what we've seen now is already evidence that she can play at this level. Whether it's something that can endure, I mean, the other thing is people haven't got much recent data on her because she's been out of the loop for so long, and a lot of these players haven't felt her game properly before. I kind of think this might be the peak of it. I think she could have a good Australian Open because she's won it before, but I think this is above what I would have expected. What is it, fourth round? I think that's a really good result. That might be the best it gets.
I do too, and I think it's fantastic, and I could see her doing other Grand Slam fourth rounds and similar kind of results at tour level, but that explicitly is not what she's come back for. So I wonder how long that will keep her juices flowing if she butts up against a ceiling. I don't see her contending with Sabalenka's and Świątek's.
Coco predicted that she'd be seeded at a slam soon. Even did she say at the Australian Open, even, which
I think
is
she did,
pretty
yeah.
ambitious. I mean, I can see that, but yeah, I feel like the game has moved on, and that is the takeaway. And I was comparing it. I have to admit, I haven't listened to the Clijsters episode yet. I feel very ashamed.
There's
about
no
this.
Need to confess that on air.
Very ashamed. But
yes,
the,
though, he said.
But
playing home.
I mean, Clijsters came back and was right on top of it from the first tournament virtually. As I remember.
Yeah, she was. And she speaks in that show that you've not listened to about how she said to her trainer, I think I can win the US Open. This was after very narrowly losing out to Yelena Yankovic, who was then world number one in Cincinnati or Montreal. I can't remember which one. But, you know, that I do sense that Wozniacki's coming back with a similar kind of sass and self-belief. She really believes in herself. She always has, and she thinks she's got the goods to challenge. She doesn't have the firepower that Clijsters has had,
no.
and I really do think that this is maybe about as good as it gets.
And the game has moved on because more players are using that combination of pace and spin, whereas go back to her generation and you had the Sharapovas, who hit with the laser Lansdorp method just over the net. That was the kind of dominant style, low, quick through the court, and that is changing. I mean, Peyton Stearns is a great example of that. That forehand is a
Brady-like,
different beast.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally Brady-like, and I hadn't seen much of her, but those players are everywhere. Goff's forehand is shonky at times, but it has that potential to do that as well, and so it's a very different kind of player that Wozniacki is taking on. And when she meets those players, I don't see how she's going to get past them.
now I'm going to be actively looking for opportunities to say the word shonky for the remainder of the podcast. We don't know who Coco Gauff will play yet in the quarterfinals because Iga Świątek and Elena Ostapenko haven't played yet. They will have played by the time you hear from us in just a few minutes' time on part two. The other quarterfinal from this top half of the draw has been set. That will be Karolina Muchová against Sorana Kostea. Kostea getting the better of a quite shonky Belinda Bencic today. I asked David for an assessment of this match and he said, Kostea very good, Bencic very bad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand really how she can be that bad when she's as talented as she is. And I look, maybe she wasn't well or something like that. I don't know. I didn't go to her press conference. But I brought it up in commentary with Coco Vandeweghe and she said, yeah, sometimes she just throws in a terrible performance, and because her whole thing is to stand in and take everything early, she refuses to compromise. And so you can sometimes just get an absolute shocker of a performance from her. And I mean, Kostea is playing well. I think this is the best I've ever seen her play.
Yeah,
contained tennis, not just hitting out, and well worth the win. I mean, she could have won even more straightforwardly.
Yeah, she really should be on the intensity list, Sorana Kostea, I think, or certainly Sorana Kostea 2.0. But I'm going to follow Matt's lead on lists and make it entirely subjective and down to me. And I just
absolutely,
she said too much gross stuff on the internet for me to have her on any list of mine. But she is very intense and she's a good watch, and I do think she's playing the best tennis of her life.
Yes, 14 years between her two Grand Slam quarterfinals. 2009 was her first.
Wow.
2023, which is the second longest gap in history after Lucic Baroni.
Is it Thomas Johansson that she hired?
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
People are going to be looking to work with him, what he's done with her.
He worked with Borna Coric a while back.
He's worked with a lot of players.
And it didn't last very long, but I remember actually seeing them on the practice court at Cincinnati at that time, and I thought, I can't remember the specifics, it was probably 2016, something like that. I can't remember what I saw, but I remember going away and thinking, wow, he's a really good coach. I can see him bringing the best out of Borna Coric, and they split up soon afterwards, but yeah. It doesn't surprise me that he's a good coach.
He was one of the ones that Caroline Wozniacki turned to for a very short spell as a kind of consultant coach before suddenly thinking, oh no, my dad's my coach. And he had a number of coaching assignments like that that just didn't last that long. But whenever, I mean, I know him quite well from the ATP days. Lovely guy and really considered, always thought he'd be a good coach.
Is he one of the Swedes that you were threatening to text last night, David? Matt was working on a stat, but he had a query relating to
Joachim Nystrom
and David very enthusiastically and eagerly at about 2 o'clock in the morning said, do you want me to text a Swede?
I do have a lot of Swedes in my phone book.
They've gone from being the superpower of tennis playing to the superpower of tennis coaching, haven't they?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the pipeline at the bottom of that process has sort of dried up.
Their failure to replicate the success of yesteryear is one of the things that really fascinates me.
Muchová next for Kostea. Now, this is a weird one. She beat Wang Zhenyu today, 6-3, 5-7, 6-1. I watched quite a lot of this match, but pretty much none of the second set, which is the one that Muchová lost. So what I saw was Muchová being just excellent. I was so impressed with her today. She looked so athletic and calm and comfortable, and shot selection looked all there. Just a dream to watch, and just composed and not just fit, but not even worrying about picking up an injury. Any anxiety seemed to be gone, and I wasn't worrying about her getting injured. It's the first time I felt relaxed watching Karolina Muchová in so long. But obviously something happened in the second set, and I'm hoping Matt will be able to tell you what.
Yeah, you did well to avoid the second set.
Right.
It was not pretty. And it was really hot today. I mean, we should we should say that. I think we're expecting a really hot spell now over the next few days. I think conditions are going to be a factor in a lot of matches, and today felt like a day where that was the case, and Mukova was not enjoying it in that second set. Neither player was, really. The quality was quite low in that second set. Mukova's analysis afterwards is that she got into a hitting contest with Wong rather than using her slice and her variety in that second set. She just tried to out-hit her, and it didn't work. And I always find Mukova so interesting because she's definitely, well, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I don't think she would be on the intensity list. And I almost feel like that can be a real strength of hers, the way she's so calm and sort of level-headed. But I can sometimes think that matches of hers just sort of drift a little bit. And I think this was one of those. And she had to take she took a big break after the second set to change all her clothes, and she came out much better in that third set and did suddenly look comfortable again. And yeah, she's now completed her set of Grand Slam quarterfinals. She's made that round of all four slams, which makes total sense. Like, her game works on all surfaces. If she's fit, I think she probably is one of the best eight players in the world. And yeah, interesting quarterfinal against Costaya. They've met three times already this year, and it's 2-1 head-to-head lead for Mukova, including very recently in Montreal in straight sets. But yeah, I really think Costaya's playing well this tournament. I think it's pretty balanced, that quarterfinal.
Those two matches were on Armstrong, as was Francis Tiafoe getting the better of Rinki Hijikata, 6-4, 6-1, 6-4. A class apart, Tiafoe, today. Incredibly professional, real game face situation for him. It's like second week of the slam that I told everyone I was going to win last year. This is different now, and I love to see him, penis in a scribble, locked in the way that he is. There were absolutely crazy queues outside Armstrong to get into this. In fact, there were crazy queues for absolutely everything today. It's Labor Day weekend. They've had record crowds in this weekend. I think they've had record crowds in all week, and that's obviously fantastic. The fact that that appetite is there for this event is brilliant, but questions are being asked about whether they are overfilling this place. It feels it to me, and I know that's, you know, finding a negative in what's basically a positive situation, but David and I had to do a relay in a drinks queue yesterday, and what was it, about half an hour?
Oh, and the
to
rest.
Queue for a drink, and then you get to the front and they tell you you can only buy two per person. It's the land of freedom unless you're a woman or you're trying to buy more than two alcoholic drinks at a time.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear from our listeners who come to the US Open every year to get their take on if it's got worse, because it does feel a bit too busy here. I mean, I think of the French Open this year actually reducing the capacity, I think by 2,000, because they decided that it was too busy and the sort of fan experience for those who were there was worse than it had been. So they made that decision. That's obviously maybe extreme. It's a difficult balance to, you know, you want to get as many people in as you can, you would think. I do think generally this week there's been an issue of Ash finishing so early with only two matches in the day session. That has quite often been done by 3:34. The day session on Ash have then got 2 or 3 hours before they're maybe even thinking about heading home. Where do 24,000 people go? If there's nothing to watch on Ash, they go and fill up the outside courts and the bars and everything, of course. And that, I think, has led to some overcrowding during the days as well. Something, I'm sure they'll be looking at, but not wanting probably to, you know, do too much about, because, yeah, loads of people coming to tennis is great.
There was a slightly weird phenomenon in the first week where every ticket was sold, and yet the Ash lower decks were quite empty, weren't they? And I was talking to a TV executive who was saying that is a real headache for them, because it does somewhat kill the buzz. I suppose some of those matches possibly killed the buzz a little bit as well.
It's because they're all stuck in a queue for a honey juice, Simon.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where they all are.
It's actually where the enormous size of Ash, which is so much larger than any other tennis stadium can work against it. It's the only stadium where you actually have a better view of Manhattan than you do of this is from the top deck than you do of the tennis.
It's an astonishing turnaround, isn't it? From a pandemic 3 years ago meant that the place was deserted. And here we are. And it genuinely, I mean, I've been coming 20 years. It's the busiest it's felt to me. And on one level, that is reason to just really celebrate because the buzz is back and it's lovely to have that. But it does feel a bit much, really. And I think that there does need to be a sensible cutoff.
You only want this many people coming if they're all leaving, having a positive experience, saying, I want to come back next year, I think is the point that lots of people are making. Tiafoe next will have to contend with Bugs Bunny energy. Francis Tiafoe's words, folks, not mine, although I will be using them extensively. And he, of course, there is referring to good vibes Ben Shelton. 6-4, 6-3, 4-6, 6-4 for him over Tommy Paul. Totally outplayed his countrymen today. He grew in the spotlight of an Arthur Ashe Stadium fourth round match, and Tommy Paul shrunk in that space. And I was really not expecting to say that today. David, you predicted this, so I'll let you gloat and I'll hand it over to you because I did not see this coming.
Listen, I didn't expect it to happen like this. I thought a shock was possible because, you know, for a couple of sets he played him close in Australia, but he looked very immature, Shelton, and Paul looked like the grown-up. But I have noticed that Paul doesn't look completely comfortable in the spotlight of his own country when he's supposed to deliver. And I understand that. I think he's quite shy, quite understated, and Shelton could not be more opposite. So one guy slightly shrunk, as you say, and the other one just, this is what I'm all about. And he came out and he was 3-love down, and there were points for 4-love for Tommy Paul. But the moment that Shelton had his feet underneath him, he just took it over. And I mean, look, he's benefited from a year of some pretty unpleasant losses along the way, which have all just been part of the learning curve of becoming a professional tennis player. And they don't matter because they're all leading to this, where he can be himself. And he goes up two sets. And then there was one game that I will never forget as long as I live. And it was him coming out and hitting 140 miles an hour, a 141 mile an hour serve, the first serve, 149 mile an hour ace, second serve, which had Tommy Paul sarcastically clapping the crowd because they were going so wild for this ace. He clearly didn't like that. And then he hit a 130 mile an hour one at the body, and then he hit another 149 mile an hour serve, all in one game. And I've never seen anything like that. It was showboat serving. It was stuff that his dad would tell him not to do. Hit the marks. That's where you get a... He just couldn't help himself.
And that was in the set that he lost.
Yes, that's right, because he was a break-up. He was 4-2 up. He should have been winning that. It was so exciting and exhilarating to watch him just put on a show. And I loved every minute of it.
This was another match. It's sort of a twin set with the Coco Gauff Caroline Garcia match, in another match where we got fantastic insight from the on-court microphones in the coaching boxes. Ben Shelton and his dad slash coach Brian were having some tremendously illuminating exchanges. Tommy's pissed. Brad told him the wrong spots on serve was a personal favourite. Revealed that his tactic was to go soft into the Tommy Paul forehand and make him generate the power on that shot, and he was just openly reveling in how well that tactic was working. It was brilliant, I thought.
So they're giving away their secrets for next time around. Well, that Tommy Paul forehand is an odd-looking shot, isn't it? It sort of it doesn't have great charisma, that forehand.
Whereas the rest of his game does.
He moves
beautifully.
Yeah, it really does stand out. I am obsessed with the Ben Shelton service motion. Like, I just think
that's definitely got charisma.
Yes, like the way he just throws his whole body into it is kind of unique, I think, in terms of modern day players. It feels to me a bit like a bit of a throwback serve. And he's got this extraordinary record this year of reaching the quarterfinals in Australia and then not winning back-to-back matches on the tour until this week, which, you know, is kind of crazy when you look at it, but actually when you think about it, it sort of makes a bit of sense. Like, he made this splash, and then, you know, he was literally away from home, away from America for the first time in his life, travelling the tour for the first time. I imagine that as great it all is to him, and as, you know, much as he enjoys being Ben Shelton, that must have been a bit tricky to sort of navigate that for the first time. And now he's back in America and he's loving it, and he's getting these stages which he's just made for, and it feels like there's so much more to come from him. Like, I still think, you know, if Juan Carlos Ferreira thinks that Carlos Alcaraz in March of this year was, what, 60% of the way through, it feels like Ben Shelton might be about 60% himself. Like, there's so much more to come. I think he's still figuring out how to actually use his backhand. He sometimes just bunts it. He sometimes really hits through it. I don't think his decision making on the court is quite all there
yet.
The
return's improved, hasn't
it? Really has, since Australia. The way he was able to get much more into Paul's service games today showed that. And yeah, I love the way he imposed himself today. It was really fun to watch.
And then these are the results that we want. Speaking of someone who likes to see tennis going gangbusters, and this is the off day for Brits. So in the media room, you know, me and my colleagues have been taking these opposite days a little quiet, but to see Coco and Shelton both coming through, these are the kind of champions who will generate interest around the world and bring more American fans and bring more TV money. I mean, these are the guys, no offence to Tommy Paul, but they are potentially saviours for the sport in America, where they, as we know, since Serena, they haven't had too much to shout about.
Can we have a word for Eddie? Eddie learnt a tough life lesson today, didn't he?
Yeah, little Eddie, who has been in Tommy Paul's corner ever since he was two sets to love down. We told you about the other night and said, I'm going to be here all night for you, Tommy, if you win. And he was, and he came back the next day, and he came back today, and he was leading the chants today.
He was the only person that believed at two sets. Yeah. I'm not sure Tommy Paul would have won that third set without Eddie.
Yeah. I was trying to get hashtag Eddie effect trending.
8 years old, I think, back to front cap, giving it the full, come on, Tommy!
Yeah, Eddie's a good vibe. Tommy Paul was asked in press, I think it was the last question in his press conference, will Eddie be in Australia? And he chuckled and said, maybe. So put a pin in Eddie. Go back to school, Eddie, just for a bit, and hopefully see you in Australia. Right then, night session is just getting underway as we come to you. Taylor Fritz is serving for the second set over Dominic Stricker, has served for the second set over Dominic Stricker. Novak Djokovic is already in control against Borna Gojic. Świątek against Ostapenko feels like the one in the night session tonight. So we'll be back with part two to wrap all of that up. But in the remainder of part one, we want to talk about Simon Scoop, which is the story that you published today, Simon, in the Telegraph, that the ATP and WTA Tours are reportedly taking the first steps towards a potential merger. And I do say first steps tentatively. We know how difficult a landscape it is to do any form of collaboration in this sport or to instigate any kind of change, but that does seem to be the case. Executives and tournament representatives are set to attend a two-day summit in London at the end of this month. This is prompted by fears of a LIV Golf-style threat and the growing power of the PTPA, which you describe, Simon, as having led to a febrile atmosphere among tennis administrators. The tours have been contacted for comment, but nothing yet. What a scoop.
Well, it's unusual that you could say that there's an exciting tennis politics story that you get to write. It's a bit of an oxymoron normally, but this is quite exciting because we've been talking about potential collaboration between the two tours for so long, and there hasn't been any real take-up or buy-in from the people running them. Roger Federer tweeted about it in the pandemic year, of course, and was shouted down by Nick Kyrgios immediately. But the fact that they're meeting in London and they've got executives from both tours going along, it's a starting point that could turn into something really important and maybe take us out of this period of fragmentation. We still have a lot of moving parts in the game, but to have men and women on the same body eventually, it'd take years probably to get to that point, would still reduce a hell of a lot of tension and inefficiency and duplication, and just give them with such a greater opportunity to sell TV rights as a package. It seems like a win-win, doesn't it, for all of us? And the only people who I can imagine will be probably concerned about it are male players who make maybe 75% more money at the moment than their female equivalents, and maybe worrying that if that was to be redistributed, they'll end up as net losers. They're the ones that might be wanting to put a foot in the door of the negotiations and say, hang on, we haven't been consulted about this.
It's very important that women are always the net losers. Mm. Yeah. It's interesting that this seems to be coming, Simon, from a feeling of real threat of a Saudi Arabian takeover bid or rival tour, because I thought the noises we were hearing out of both tours this summer were sort of total acquiescence to the Saudis and an invitation to them to get involved in order to fend off that threat. That was the move. That was their way of saying, don't worry, we're not going to resist this. We'll let you in. There's no need to launch an offensive.
So we've obviously got the next-gen ATP going to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia's second city. So I was told at the start of the fortnight that the Saudis are very, very keen on a 10th Masters event, but there's very difficult to work out where
tennis,
you would put it.
You say.
Yeah, I mean,
that's all the world needs.
And that they really want it on Jan 1, which if...
As in January the 1st.
Yeah, if the ATP were going to go along with that, they'd basically be taking a cannon and aiming it squarely at Tennis Australia, who have staged the United Cup this year for the first time. So there's a sense that everyone's a little bit squeezed because of all the different manoeuvrings that are going on. But I suspect that actually maybe the bosses of the ATP and the WTA might be quite glad that they've got this bogeyman out there, because without the bogeyman, then nothing is likely to change. It's maybe that they're using to motivate people to look at the bigger picture, because as we've just said, we've been talking about this, well, Billie Jean King has been talking about it for 50 years. So maybe they might have been harnessing it, and maybe even encouraging that feeling of impending crisis, because that's what it takes to get something done.
And what about the PTPA? Because we quite often joke about sort of how little we see of the PTPA. This, what was it? How many years ago was it? There was the famous photo shoot. Four years ago of them all on the court.
I think it was pandemic.
They were wearing masks. So, yeah. Big song and dance, with lots of noises, but they are...
You can very much rely on them now for a statement to come out about an episode 3 days late in a typeface font that you really have to squint to try and read.
A feeble statement 3 days after the fact in a bizarre form of graphic design. Like, to me, they don't feel like a big force, but perhaps that's just the public face. It sounds like what you're hearing is that behind the scenes they do have more force.
The fear among the tours would be that eventually the PTPA sign up enough players that they can go to the slams and say, we're going to negotiate with you on pay deals. And then you are taking the tours out of that loop, and it's a massive blow to their prestige. I think it's maybe somewhere away. The difficulty for the PTPA, I have got some sympathy with them, because when they try and say something about an event in tennis, they're faced with the same problem that the two tours face, which is that this is a zero-sum sport in which everything that I get is something that you're not getting. And so representing the entire locker room is philosophically impossible. Because coming to a university-beneficial view on anything, just it's it's a real challenge. So the advantage of going back to the merger is that potentially, if you do have these two tours coming together, it might not be a zero-sum game. You might actually grow the pie. You might actually have a product that is more appealing to sponsors, more appealing to broadcasters, and maybe even fans. And so you don't... Eventually, people will realise that just because you're doing better, it doesn't mean that I'm doing worse.
Right. And that feels like it will be the big message to get across to those... 100%. ...male players who will...
100%, you know, yeah.
Yes, you may stop earning relatively more to the women, but you will earn more yourself overall because the pie will be bigger and the product will be stronger.
And if you look at the players on the player council at the moment, I think they're the kind of people who have open minds and who will probably understand that message. But they would definitely will have some raging emails in their inboxes.
Mm. This is probably an impossible question, Simon, but do you have any feel for the likelihood of this actually happening?
I don't think so, no. But there is just that feeling of optimism that Steve Simon and Andrea Gaudenzi have made a strong play. They've acted. Whether they get anywhere, I as you say, it's so hard to know.
Does it feel like now or never?
Well, I think that's kind of their argument.
Hmm.
And maybe that's also why they're waving the many other stakeholders who might come into the game at their own constituencies and saying, you know, we need to get on with this. It's time.
Mm. It's very interesting. Look, I think we're all in the right circumstances, in principle, hugely in favour of a merger, aren't we? But
well, I mean,
just the thought of the administrative...
Yeah.
And ideological battle that will be going on at those 2 days of meetings.
It's
just a headache in itself.
The experience we have of travelling the circuit and seeing tennis tournaments and knowing that the sport is at its best when men and women are playing at the same time and joining forces at the events. Look at this place, for goodness sake. You know, look at the crowds that are coming to watch Coco Golf and both tours, for goodness... You know, lean into that, make the most of that, celebrate that, join together and just go and kill it in the market, for goodness sake. That's what the whole idea is. That business wise that makes sense to me, and just bloody hell, what a revelation it is that tennis can be the one that actually does it.
Don't squander your advantage, the advantage that Billie Jean King and others won for this sport. Other sports are desperately trying to catch up with tennis and are catching up with tennis, and tennis has sat on its laurels for so long.
I mean, I say that on my very daily life, that my colleagues in other sports, their stories are usually promoted on the sports page. I have a higher chance of having mine promoted on the homepage, the general Telegraph website, because it's a sport that reaches across both genders.
Absolutely.
So like you say, it's the USP.
Absolutely. Yeah, here. Well, look, we'll watch the situation very closely. For more scoops, do follow Simon Briggs.
It could be a while.
Hey, Simon, you started this tournament. You didn't think you were going to get anywhere, and now look at it.
You've got Jack Draper in the fourth round, and you've got a big scoop. It's going gangbusters.
It's been a bit Brit-tastic, isn't it?
Yeah, week one has, yeah.
And all the winners are like quite good, aren't they? For the second week.
I mentioned TFO as well. He's another like buzz factor, isn't he?
Looming behind you for quite a long time there when you were talking. But I didn't want to interrupt you. But he was in a big fluoro hoodie, just turning every head because he's just.
It's disappointing
just
that,
a magnet,
that he's not wearing the onesie from the Australian Open, isn't it?
Is it a disappointment, Simon?
I was going to do I think I might have told you this before, I was going to do a first-person photo shoot in one of those if he got to the quarterfinals.
Please.
He's in the quarterfinals.
No, when he was wearing it.
Oh.
What about this one? Can you do this one?
I haven't actually really clocked what he's wearing, but it's not quite as dramatic, is it?
It's
something
that
dramatic.
Would...
I want to see you in it.
Still cause a stir. To be discussed, folks. I feel like that's a bombshell on which we can safely end part one. Simon, thank you. Thank you very much. Fascinating stuff, as always. We'll be back with part two in just a few moments.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Longlen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Welcome back to part two, where we're at Tennis Podcast Towers. It's 5 past midnight and we've entered a brave new world because the former world number one and defending champion Iga Swiatek is out at the hands of Yelena Ostapenko. And yes, I did say former, because that defeat for Iga Swiatek means that Aryna Sabalenka, come a week Monday or come a week today, will be the new world number one. Suddenly, everything has changed, David, all thanks to Yelena Ostapenko.
And you saw it coming, because Catherine went for that in the newsletter predictions. And, of course, that was always a possibility. She had a healthy head-to-head, a 100% head-to-head against Iga Swiatek. But those were not recent results. At the same time, we know just how explosive Yelena Ostapenko can be. There's no other player like her. Even as hard as players like Aryna Sabalenka hit the ball, they don't hit it like that. It's more relentless with those sort of players, but not as explosive, not as sort of show-stopping as Ostapenko's ball strike is. It's audacious. It's frankly ridiculous what she tries to do. And sometimes she pulls it off, and sometimes she pulls it off a lot. And tonight, she pulled it off for 2 out of 3 sets, which is all she needed to do. We were talking about it at the start. You know, if she could make it chaotic, it could become her night. I still didn't see it coming, Catherine. Personally, I was shocked by what I saw.
Yeah, look, I don't want to take too much credit. I picked it because I thought it was a possibility, and there was I felt like the risk reward. It's all about the risk reward ratio, and I liked the look of it because the head-to-head meant it was always a possibility. It didn't mean it was a likelihood. I mean, obviously, in hindsight, maybe it was a likelihood, but no, I didn't feel confident about that prediction at all. And yet, it now feels patently clear that Iga Swiatek has a Yelena Ostapenko problem, because as Pam Shriver pointed out in the ESPN coverage before the match, it's not just Ostapenko, it is players like Ostapenko. And there aren't many like Ostapenko, as David was saying. She's she's pretty much one of a kind, but it is a style matchup that Iga Świątek does not like.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I was not reading like an enormous amount into the head-to-head going into this match because of the fact that they were before Iga Świątek became world number one. But actually, when Pam Shriver said that in the build-up, I was like, oh gosh, yeah, that's so true, because Ostapenko, the style of play, as David said, unique, but it's flat, big flat hits. And we've seen Elena Rybakina do that to Iga Świątek and win. We've seen Jessica Pegula do that a couple of times this year and win. And Ostapenko did it tonight. And of course, what that head-to-head did do is give Ostapenko immense belief. Like, I think that was important as well. Like, she said before the match that she can take advantage of the fact that, you know, Świątek's always out to be beaten because she's the world number one. And she said before that she has the tools, the game plan to beat her. And she brought all of that to bear. That belief, that game style that Iga Świątek doesn't like. But having said that, I thought Iga Świątek played a great first set and was really dealing with that game style pretty well. There was a lot of moments where Iga Świątek was getting behind the ball and timing it back and not framing it or shanking it and turning it back on Ostapenko, looking focused. I thought she was brilliant in that first set, Iga Świątek.
And also, I think, doing a good job of accepting that there were going to be moments, periods where it was out of her control,
yeah,
and not getting too stressed about that.
Mm-hmm. Totally. We didn't actually see the first two games of the second set because ESPN cut to a studio interview with Novak Djokovic. But Ostapenko held at the start of the second set. Świątek had 40-15 on serve and then lost serve from 40-15 up. And it does seem like from that moment on, that was a real turning point. It seemed like, I think, some of the stress came for Iga Świątek. And honestly, that was a really poor third set that she played. As good as Ostapenko was, it was over in 15 or 20 minutes. It was exactly what we said at the start of the year. Where's the Iga Świątek resilience? You know, we'd seen a lot of it in the past couple of months at the French Open. You know, in the build-up to the US Open, she played some big, tight three-set matches. And yes, this was three sets today, but it really got away from her in a very alarming fashion. And I don't think it was all Ostapenko in that third set. It was great hitting, but I thought Iga Świątek just let it run away from her.
Yeah, I mean, a 6-1 set against Iga Świątek. For someone like Ostapenko, she can break anyone's serve, but Świątek should have been doing a better job on the Ostapenko serve. There were a couple of service games from Ostapenko there that were over in sort of a minute-ish. Mm. That shouldn't really be happening. She did have a great night on serve. She had almost 10, I think, sort of midway through the third set, she was up to 7 aces. I mean, that's great stuff. But even so, she didn't feel under any pressure on serve in that third set, Ostapenko. And, you know, that's alien to her. She's so used to losing serve that she doesn't think anything of it, does she? It sort of changes the dynamic of a match, really. You don't sort of fear for her when she loses serve, because she just shrugs it off and goes, yeah, that's fine. I mean, she shrugs everything off. And she didn't even celebrate that much. Her celebration was like, well, that's great, but sort of like, of course, I've beaten her every time we've played. Like, obviously this was going to happen. And I just, love that about her.
She is the most fun time in tennis. Or one of them. I mean, I think I judge the players I like to watch the most by how much I laugh during the match at the absurdity of what they're doing. And that happens a lot when I watch Carlos Alcaraz, and it happens a lot when I watch Yelena Ostapenko. And with the added bonus of her facial expressions after winners, unforced errors, Hawkeye calls that she doesn't agree with. It's just always entertaining watching her. But that's to sometimes overlook just what an incredible talent she is. How she can time the ball like she does, hitting it as flat as she does, sometimes looking as though she's hitting it late, and then still managing to muscle it back with just incredible timing. It's not muscle, it's not just brute force. She has the most extraordinary ball strike, and the ball flies off and often hits the backstop after one bounce, and it's a joke what she's doing.
Yeah, I thought she was moving well tonight as well, actually. I mean, I know it wasn't a match that was decided by movement, because it was just, it was about ball striking. But when required, there were a couple of, there were a few sort of hustly points in there from Ostapenko, and I thought, wow, I'm not sort of used to seeing her in those situations. And I thought she dealt with it quite well. I mean,
there wasn't enough hustle from Świątek.
No.
Was there? That was a poor mental performance in the end. At the end, I mean, because in the first set she handled that pace, something's gone wrong there.
Like, she can do it. Like, yeah. She showed she can do it in the first set. It's not like she just got totally blown off the court and just couldn't handle it. She was handling it, and then suddenly she couldn't, and she couldn't get it back. And she lost her last five service games, Świątek. I mean, I do think she's got to improve that serve. I mean, I know Ostapenko is pretty unique in the way that she can attack it. But then all year we've said that the way to get at Świątek is to take advantage of that serve. And, you know, if you're the world number one, I mean, she's not anymore, but if you're the best player in the world, that's what we've seen all the best players do over the years, constantly just get that little bit better. And it does seem like that's an area where Świątek's maybe got some of the most room for improvement, I think, on serve.
It's the whole losing number one thing is almost too big to process right now, isn't it? It's just been second nature. Iga Świątek being world number one. I know it's been sort of hovering on the horizon for a few weeks now. Sabalenka potentially taking it over, and yes, it's been there, but I don't know. I just wasn't prepared for this tonight, at all, it's a lot to process. I do think there's a world in which that really affects Świątek, losing number one. I don't think she's a sort of, I don't think about the ranking person. I really think she's a, yep, I'm number one, I'm the best player in the world person. I think that, I can't, as I say, haven't had time to process. I can't, not doing a very good job of explaining it, but I can definitely see a world in which that rocks her on her heels and shakes what can sometimes be a surprisingly fragile sense of self-belief in Iga Świątek. Well, we saw it tonight. She won the first set. You think you've got this, and yet it all suddenly looked so frail.
I suppose, yeah, as you said, so soon, so hard to process. I suppose, is there a chance it goes the other way? And, like, I don't think, like, I think I completely agree, it's been important to her sense of self-belief, and she's owned number one pretty well, and it's an extraordinary streak of 74, 75 weeks at number one.
75, yeah.
Like, straight out the bat. Like, that's amazing how she made that number one her own at such an uncertain time with Ash Barty retiring. But I don't think it necessarily suits her sort of personality-wise. I think there have been times where she's felt the burden of number one as well, particularly at the start of the year.
Don't you think she's sort of gone through that tunnel now, and now she does see herself as very defined by
perhaps being
number one?
Yeah, but I, as you said, she's been this number one, and she's been so dominant, and she racks up scores like 6-love, 6-1 all the time. And yet you sometimes watch her and you think there's a fragility there still.
Yeah, it might free her up a little bit to be the underdog in her own mind for a little while. It's impossible to know, really.
It's fascinating.
We haven't seen this for a year and a half.
It really could go to two opposite ends of the spectrum. You're right. It could totally free her up and unburden her, or it could you know, we always talk about her being on the edge, don't we? I worry. I've talked about feeling like the way that she makes it work at the top of the game feels unsustainable to me in the long term, and I do wonder if this could provoke some sort of crisis. But or she could just, you know, carry on being extremely good at tennis, but number two in the world for a bit, rather than number one. Who knows?
It is close up there, isn't it?
And what about Sabalenka?
Well, what's it going to do for Sabalenka's sense of self and belief? Because she might turn into a new player.
I think a lot of that might hinge on what actually happens for the rest of this tournament. You know, like if Sabalenka assumes the number one ranking, which she will, but does the thing of losing again in the semi-final.
That's the thing. I'm sort of wondering whether now...
Oh, for the rest of the tournament.
Well, I kind of wonder whether... I think she'll be ravenous to underline this now. I mean, she's ravenous every match, isn't she? But you know what I mean? I think maybe she might walk even with a bit more swagger and self-belief. I'm world number one. I'm going to come out and get you all.
Fascinating. I mean, it has been a theme of the year, hasn't it? Players getting a bit closer to Iga Swiatek, like Sabalenka, Rybakina,
Ostapenko,
Goff,
yeah. Pegula. Like it does feel like the gap has closed, but yeah, it is strange that Iga Swiatek isn't the world number one. We're so used to it, and I think even within this tournament. To me now, the tournament feels very different as well. Like I didn't think Iga Swiatek was like guaranteed to win this by any means, but just her not being in the draw feels like it opens up so many possibilities for kind of everyone that's left. Like I was looking at the players left in that top half, and you would perhaps slightly say Castea is slightly aside just because she's never been past the quarterfinals of a slam, but you know, she is playing very well. You've got Goff now.
I think this improves Goff's chances a lot. Yeah.
I think it has to, considering the 1-7 head-to-head against Swiatek that she had. But, you know, also Mukova and Ostapenko has won a major before.
And beat Goff in a major this year. I think Goff's a better player now, but... you know, we've seen what Ostapenko does with... you know, good head-to-heads and belief and her game. It's really compelling. It's really, really compelling.
First time US Open champion guaranteed in the women's draw now. Yeah, I mean, Swiatek just takes up so much space in my thinking about the tournament, I suppose, just because of what she's done. Like, and suddenly you remove her, and it just feels like even more players have a chance in a way. I don't know why, it just feels like the mix got bigger tonight.
And I think even players that weren't due to face Swiatek next, obviously that's Coco Gauff. I just think for everybody, Swiatek would have been this looming feature somewhere in their consciousness.
Exactly.
Just a blight on it, and that's gone.
Yeah, if you're starting to think of, oh, who might come out of the bottom half, and you think, okay, they might get through that half, but Swiatek's probably going to be there in the final. It's hard to see them actually winning. Now,
yeah, it feels all so changed. Honestly, it really does feel like a brave new world. Wow. I should have been more prepared for this, but...
Especially given your predictions.
I know, but I'm... I'm really not. It's a brave new world being second on the leaderboard. Don't think I've ever been there before, and it definitely won't last. But I will enjoy it for tonight. Couple of other things happened tonight. Novak Djokovic beat Borna Goyo in straight sets. We got anything to say about that?
Pretty uneventful.
No brave new world there.
No brave new world.
Straightforward. Played very well.
He will face Taylor Fritz in the quarterfinals, who... beat Dominic Stricker in straight set. Stricker did break the Taylor Fritz serve. No one else has done that yet this tournament. Fritz has done what we asked of him. He now needs to go out there and give Novak Djokovic a match.
Yeah, he's done the bare minimum for what his draw was. had, and look, he's done it in straight sets efficiently. That's impressive. But he's absolutely done the bare minimum. Because if he had have not done this, I'd have been panning him. Now, he needs to produce against Novak Djokovic. Not win, because Djokovic is a better player than him. And if Djokovic plays to his best ability, he will win anyway. But Fritz has to play and play well.
All I have to say left about that match is I'm fascinated to see when it will be scheduled. I don't think Djokovic has played day session yet. The other quarterfinal in that half is an All-American clash. It's Ben Shelton against Francis Tiafoe. But on Tuesday, it's scheduled to be 35 degrees here. Novak Djokovic will be pushing as hard as he'll be pushing as hard as a Yelena Ostapenko forehand for that to be another night session match. And quite right too. Push for what you want doesn't mean they have to listen. I'm fascinated about which way round they do that scheduling, because I think it's pretty big for Novak Djokovic. Yeah. I'd still back him in a day session.
But it is a different proposition, isn't
that
it?
That could be Novak Djokovic with a hat on, David.
Yeah. And then, and you know, he never wins with hats on, or not very often.
He played his second round in the day.
Oh.
But, like, it's going to be really hot over the next few days. And those are not conditions that Novak Djokovic wants and likes.
So he has played once. Okay.
So the other match is Tiafoe Shelton.
Mm.
I think that should be the night match.
I do too. And I think all other things being equal, I think ESPN will want that to be the... I know it's Djokovic against an American, but Tiafoe's a bigger deal than that. And certainly Tiafoe against Ben Shelton. I think they want that in the night match. But Djokovic is the 23-time Grand Slam champion.
Yeah.
And he'll be pushing hard. Watch this space. Tune in tomorrow. We'll let you know what the schedule is for the next day. This is the schedule for tomorrow at the US Open. What's the first match of the day on Ash, David? The app
Jessica
is loading.
Pegula versus Madison Keys.
Yeah.
I think Pegula's got that. Why are you volunteering predictions, Catherine? Mm. Keys against Pegula. Then it's Alcaraz against Arnaldi. Night session. The world... Hey, this has worked out actually kind of perfectly, hasn't it? Aryna Sabalenka will play her first Arthur Ashe Stadium match this tournament, debuting as world number one.
Yeah, I'm really pleased for her. Actually.
Yeah, she'll face Daria Kasatkina. And then it's Zverev against Sinner, the last... match on Ash tomorrow. Peyton Stearns against Marketa Vondroušová first on Armstrong. Then it's Jack Draper taking on Andrei Rublev. Ons Jabeur against Zhong Xin Wen is next. And then Daniel Medvedev against Alex de Minaur. Goff and Pegula in doubles action tomorrow. Azarenka Haddad-Meier. Ben Shelton still in the mixed. It's all happening, folks. We've been talking all day, haven't we, about how perfectly set up week two feels. It just feels like one of those tournaments that's building. And not we were worried in the men's side, weren't we, that it would all feel like preamble to the final.
Yeah.
The final that we all wanted. And we all want to see Djokovic Alcaraz. I think no one's going to say no to seeing that match, but it does not feel like preamble. It feels like we've got a great week ahead, all 7 days of it. So stick with us, folks. 7 more daily tennis podcasts to come from the US Open, plus all the boco that we record after it for Friends of the Tennis Podcast. If you want to become a friend, the link to do that is in our show notes, as is the link to subscribe to the newsletter. Being a newsletter subscriber is how to gain access to that incredible competition that AO Travel are offering, incredible competition prize. So the details of how to enter that are in the newsletter tonight. We have our lovely mascot, Willow. We've got our mascot, Xenia. Hey, Xenia, we've had a good one. David's got Maisie. They've had a good one too.
Come on, Maisie, you and me.
Matt and Darwin also had some...
We were fine. We got some points. Not as many, but we got some.
Not many. I mean,
points.
On.
Points are points. Points are points.
Don't I know it?
Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have executive producers. They are Jamie, Hannah and Drew, and they are all top folks. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Chris Wilkes in Tucson, Arizona.
Like Chris Wilkinson.
I was going to say like Hannah Wilkes.
Very good
does
point.
Does our Twitter.
Yes.
Tucson, Arizona. I thought I had something to say, I don't.
Bruce has a song called Tucson Train.
Very good.
Arizona, home of the Cardinals.
Mm.
Terrible NFL team at the moment.
Did we drive through Arizona? No.
No.
Chris, thanks a lot.
One of the few states in America that Matt and I haven't driven through at this point. We'll pop it on the list. Thank you, Chris.
We've got Catherine Koiser in, get this, Mount Pleasant,
wow.
South Carolina, which so is cool. Apparently 7 minutes away from the Charleston Open.
Church and pew?
Same church, same pew.
Ugh.
And Catherine says, I met David at the French Open just hey. Outside Chatrier and practically knocked over two people to get to him. He met my husband, David, and one of my daughters, Caroline, and he couldn't have been nicer.
Oh, thanks, Catherine.
We do have a disproportionate number of Catherines in the shout-out.
It is wild.
Right? It is. Yeah. Okay, I'm not imagining
it
that.
It is wild.
And make no bones about it, I love it. Thank you to all the Catherines. Thank you in particular to this Catherine.
And finally, we have Marion, who is in Mainz in Germany.
Oh, like Marion Bartoli.
Hey!
Marion says, on the day of the Women's French Open final in 2022, you gave a lovely special shout-out from me to my wife, Martina, because we were getting married that day.
I remember that.
I'm happy to report that Martina said yes. We listened to the shout-out together a couple of days later, and it was a lovely surprise. Thank you. There is a rather unfortunate addendum to that note to say, also, Iga Świątek is our favourite player, so it was perfect that she won the title, which, had I planned the shout-out as better, I might not have chosen that one for tonight. I'm very sorry, Marion.
What a note to end on. Marion, thank you and sorry. We'll be back tomorrow. Good night.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.